Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and editorial review. Law Hour is sponsored by Gordon Law School and is a fellow observer. Law Hour is an education service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and editorial review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Israel's tribes in today's modern world, right after this. You know, Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history. Surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity, from bank deposits to medical visits, has produced greater efficiency and security, all right, but it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. Now, the federal government currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American, according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. Closer to home, state and local governments use computers to keep their own files on us. And a study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems containing 10,799 categories of information about New York residents, and each system contained between 2 and 10 million records. Now, information about you is gained from 63 sources, and this information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how government, banking, insurance, business, and industry obtains all of this information about you? What are their sources? How is it stored? How is it retrieved? What do they want it for? Well, knowing how this information is gathered and what information is stored and what information you want to keep personal and private actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, if you'd like more information about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967 and ask for that free general law CD package. And let me tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and just as private as you want to be. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website and send an email. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email, send an email request for that free general law CD package. All right, last time we were talking about Israel's tribes. Today, remember that this is a book written by Stephen M. Collins. It's the fifth in a series of six books that he has undertaken over the last, 5 years probably, or maybe a little longer than that. I'm sure that the research is probably goes back many years before that. He's relied in part upon the Epigraphic Society, Barry Fell, America B.C., Gloria Farley in Plain Sight, and one of the books, the book on Parthia, deals with this thing of where did the Israelites migrate to? And the answer is, surprisingly, North and South America. Under the reigns of David and Solomon, they had outposts and colonies and mining operations in Michigan, and they had traveled up the Arkansas River as far as Denver, Colorado, and that these monuments and these Phoenician coins are all over the United States of America, and indeed they're found from time to time in Central America and South America. It's a fascinating story. I told you that you should get all five books, but the book I'm reviewing now is the newest of his series of books called Israel's Tribes Today. Where are these lost 10 tribes of Israel? Can you identify them in France or Germany or Russia, China, Japan, Bolivia, Brazil, the United States, and Canada? Are they on planet Earth today? Are they big nations like Russia and China, or are they just little groups of people hidden away in the Amazon basin, and once in a while we find one of these tribes and try to make contact with them? Well, the surprising answer, as we found in the first broadcast of the first in this series last night, was that the United States and Great Britain are the two largest of the 10 tribes that are supposedly lost. And indeed, in most history books, they are lost. Nobody knows what happened to these ancient Israelites under Kings David and Solomon, and what happened to these strange people with names like Zebulun and Reuben and Issachar and Simeon and Levi. And today, we know where the Jews are, don't we? The Jews are sitting over there in Palestine. Well, that's what we're told. And of course, they're called Israelites, and the little country is called Israel. And in most Christian minds, in religious people's minds, these are the 12 tribes of Israel. They're all right there in Palestine. Now, surprisingly, history does not support that conclusion, and neither does the Bible. And Stephen Collins has taken the time, effort, and energy to ferret out the facts, the historical facts, both secular and scriptural, concerning these lost 10 tribes. Listen to this. Ephraim and Manasseh have weaknesses as well, and when it comes to dealing with other nations, the British have historically done a better job than the Americans. Because Ephraim, the British, are more comfortable dealing with foreign nations, and Manasseh, the United States of America, is typically isolationist. The British nation had a more coherent foreign policy over the centuries, and the United States of America makes its foreign policy decisions which bewilder many other nations. In the days of the British Empire, its foreign policy was predictable, and British foreign policy was based on the long-term view of British interests. Other nations may not have liked the British, but they could understand British policies, because the British made tough-minded decisions. But they could also manifest the effusive generosity and the mercy of the Americans. On the other hand, American and America have been inconsistent policies. America chose to lose the Vietnam War with self-imposed restraints and fight to a tie in Korea, but fought for complete military victories in World War II and the Persian Gulf War. Media reports in recent years have disclosed that China steals American nuclear and military secrets and is slowly destroying America's industrial base by luring American production facilities to Asia and utilizes predatory trade practices by fixing its currency to the dollar to prevent America from reducing its trade deficits. So what does America do about it? Well, America lavishes trade agreements and commercial concessions on Red China. On the other hand, Cuba, which is also communist, does not perpetrate such peacetime assaults upon America. And yet America ostracizes Cuba like they've got the bubonic plague. Does that type of foreign policy make any sense? Well, of course not. But Manasseh, the Americans, tends to make policies with its heart or its gut feelings instead of a hard-headed application of foreign policy that benefits American interests. Hence, Ephraim is predictable. And Manasseh, the Americans, are totally unpredictable in many respects. Americans, as Manassehites, are uncomfortable with the role of global superpower and global cop with an isolationist nature. Manassehites are still suited for the role of global superpower thrust on them. This is readily seen in American foreign policy decisions. As soon as American soldiers died in Somalia, the American people withdrew their support from the U.S. government's military involvement there. The American readiness to abandon support for the Balkan War, if meaningful casualties occurred, led the U.S. government's decision to wage an air campaign against Serbia instead of a more effective ground invasion. And this highlights a very fundamental difference in Ephraimites and Manassehites, or the British and Americans. While the British Ephraimites long accepted high casualties as acceptable losses in running an empire, the Americans, who have little interest in building a foreign empire, will not tolerate even small losses in an effort, not directly in a national interest. However, Manasseh will fight like an enraged tiger when its homeland, its survival, or its vital interests are at stake. Remember the Alamo, remember the Maine, remember Pearl Harbor? Well, these are the type of slogans which stimulated American resolve when America was attacked. And last but not least are the military efforts against the Taliban and the Saddam Hussein regime as a result of the current Remember 9/11 efforts. As Book 2 indicated, the Manassehites were the Massagati, or the Saki, or the Scythia, who annihilated the army of the Persian king Cyrus the Great when their homeland was invaded by the Persians. While Ephraimites can wage aggressive war to build or defend an empire, the Manassehites will become most aroused if their homeland is attacked or invaded. Both Ephraim and Manasseh manifest the naivete of their forefather Joseph. In the pre-World War II environments, when the Nazis and the Japanese were building their war machines, America let its military decline and was totally unprepared for war. British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain was a gullible foil for Adolf Hitler and gullibly declared peace in our time. But once the war began, Winston Churchill rallied the British people and the Americans became the arsenal of democracy. But both nations can be naively unaware of a building threat from abroad, and this same gullibility was manifested by the Parthians, who trusted a phony and deceitful Roman peace initiative in the 3rd century AD, even though it was very obvious that the Romans were duping them. The birthright promises that were given to Abraham included wealth, natural resources, and agricultural abundance. This also typifies the United States and the British Commonwealth. It is common knowledge that these two nations have a disproportionate share of the world's material wealth. While it is true that some of this can be attributed to English doggedness and Yankee ingenuity, the primary reason is that God, the invisible ruler, was simply keeping his promises to the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh. It is our God that has directed their migrating descendants to land masses that had strategic advantages, soil fertility, favorable climates, and an abundance of natural resources. The fact that the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh didn't grasp their Israelite ancestry did not annul God's promises. God knew who they were, and he was faithful, even if Israel's nations did not recognize him as their benefactor. Indeed, the very name Manasseh means forgetting. You'll see that in Genesis 41, Verse 51, Americans have uniquely lived up to their tribal heritage of forgetfulness about historical facts. And Manassites have a tendency to live for today, while the Ephraimites tend to take a longer historical perspective. The British look back over hundreds of years of history. Americans can't see any further back than 10 or 20 years. While Europeans have a better connection to their historical roots, most Americans know little or nothing about their great-great-grandparents, much less their national origins. Media articles periodically write about the fact that graduating American seniors in high school or college are little better than illiterates when it comes to history and geography. These are the two most important academic disciplines needed to understand one's national origins or to understand world affairs and international geopolitics. As the Associated Press article on June 28, 2000 reported, how total was the failure of the American educational system in the field of history? The conclusion was that nearly 80% of seniors at 55 top colleges and universities, including Harvard and Princeton, received a D or an F on a 34-question high school-level U.S. history test. More than a third of the students didn't know the Constitution established the division of power in U.S. government. Only 23% identified James Madison as the principal framer of the Constitution. The study, sponsored by the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, found that none of the 55 schools requires U.S. history for graduation. These students are allowed to graduate as if they didn't know the past even existed. James Rees, who oversees the estate of George Washington in Mount Vernon, Virginia, said, George Washington has been virtually eliminated from elementary school textbooks in America. Unquote. Now, modern America has virtually eliminated the critical information of two entire academic disciplines, history and geography. They are totally eliminated from the educational system in America. And to the extent that history is taught, it is little more than an uncritical recitation of Greco-Roman history, which excludes the history of empires more advanced and more civilized and more powerful and more far-reaching than either Greece or Rome. Even as Joseph dispensed grain from huge surpluses to hungry nations during the 7 lean years in Egypt, so the people of Ephraim and Manasseh have fed the world through vast agricultural production in our own time. The United States, Canada, and Australia are perennial grain exporters, and this has been an Israelite trait throughout history. The previous books in this series documented that Israel, Carthage, and Scythia were all grain exporters as well. Literally, all of the ancient biblical prophecies connected with the birthright promises given to Abraham have been fulfilled in the British and American people. And this fact confirms that, one, the British and American people are the modern tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, and two, there is a powerful invisible God who exercises sufficient control in world events and international geopolitics to personally guarantee that his prophecies come true. The fact that world events have worked out in America's favor so often give rise to a popular saying that God looks out for sinners, drunks, and the United States of America. That proverb implied that there must be a divine hand at work to cause so many favorable results for the Americans. The saying was correct insofar as the United States is concerned. However, God has not favored America because it is better, or smarter, or even more righteous than the other nations around them. The God of the Americans has extended his favor because the United States of America is primarily the birthright tribe of Manasseh, the fated heir of the world's greatest blessings, quite literally, by an act of God and fulfilled under the terms of a contract negotiated by God and his servant Abraham. Earlier, Israelite nations and empires also fulfilled other key promises of the Abrahamic covenant, controlling the gates of their enemies. Ancient Israel's Phoenician Empire under King Solomon controlled Gibraltar, the key trade routes at the nexus of three continents that converged near Jerusalem. Carthage controlled Gibraltar, the western Mediterranean, and the Atlantic Sea routes to North America. The long-standing control of Gibraltar, known as the Pillars of Hercules in ancient texts, has been a key blessing given to the tribes of Israel. Phoenician, Carthaginian control of Gibraltar barred the Greeks and Romans from the Atlantic Ocean and the western hemisphere, while the Israelite empires had free access to the world's oceans and the natural resources of other continents as far back as 1000 BC. As discussed in the second book of this series, the idea that all civilizations throughout the world was flat until the Greco-Romans figured it out is a laughable, inaccurate, popular view of history. In fact, the Israelite empires knew the world was round and had sailed the world's oceans for centuries before the Greco-Romans were allowed to even leave the Mediterranean Sea. And the Greeks and Romans were contiguous land powers. Phoenicia and Carthage were maritime powers whose dominions were non-contiguous and located on several continents. The Parthians and the Scythians were land powers, but their strategic location controlled the world's overland trade routes between the continents of Europe, Africa, and Asia. And Parthia controlled the strategic Caspian gates which sat astride the invasion routes of ancient Asia. Ancient Chinese records indicate that Parthia had ships plying the Indian Ocean, and history records that the Scythians shipped much wheat to Athens by way of sailing vessels. And we know that they had these naval skills because the Goths and the Vandals, who descended from the Scythians and Parthians, possessed the ability to construct huge fleets of ships transporting hundreds of thousands of settlers and refugees. Great Britain, like Phoenicia and Carthage, excelled in maritime skills and built great fleets for commerce and war. And as mentioned earlier, the expression Britannia rules the waves was a truism for centuries as British fleets dominated the world's oceans. The career of Lord Horatio Nelson and his historic naval victory at the Battle of Trafalgar typified the British naval power that dominated the Earth's oceans for many lifetimes. The British long possessed control of Gibraltar, the Suez Canal, Singapore, Hong Kong, and other geopolitical strategic sea gates, and many of these strategic gates were lost in the decline of the British Empire after World War II, but it still retains Gibraltar. The United States of America has also inherited a very strong naval and maritime tradition. By the time World War II ended, the United States Navy had become almost unimaginably huge. American industry built many thousands of Liberty ships, had over 100 aircraft carriers of various sizes and types, and thousands of smaller naval ships. And by the time that the war ended, until recently, America possessed the Panama Canal, one of the most strategic gates on the planet. And America recently gave away this part of its divine patrimony to Panama. The steady loss of these key sea gates, a birthright blessing given them by God's promise, indicates that Britain and America are losing key aspects of national power. And what is historically incongruous is that these important sea gates were given away by unilateral action. They were not wrestled away or taken by the results of conquest and war. The secular and biblical evidence is overwhelming that Great Britain and her company of nations are the Israelite tribe of Ephraim, and the United States of America is the Israelite tribe of Manasseh. There are other parallels to examine as well. When Manasseh received its inheritance in ancient Israel, it was given an unusually large land area, and it included two portions of land divided in the middle by the Jordan River. At the beginning, the tribe of Manasseh preferred wide open spaces. When the Israelites left their ancient homeland, the tribe of Manasseh split and went in two separate directions. The half-tribe of Manasseh, living in Gilead east of the Jordan River, went into Assyrian captivity years before the fall of Samaria. When the Assyrian Empire fell, they migrated to territories east of the Caspian Sea, where they became the Scythian tribe named the Massagetae. The other half of the tribe of Manasseh migrated in about 721 BC with the other fleeing Israelites to a new homeland near the Black Sea. They were called the Getae, or the Sakae. One historian, Tamara Talbot Rice, observed the following about the Scythians. Quote, "But since all of the mounted nomads of the Scythian age spoke the same Iranian tongue, whether they came from the Dniester, western Scythians, or the banks of the Oxus, that is, the eastern Scythians, there seems reason to think that the majority were linked by some sort of racial tie. A definite affinity is indeed suggested by the nature of their art, which shows well-nigh identical features over so wide an area." Unquote. So a common language, a common culture, and common artwork confirms their common origin, and both halves of the tribe of Manasseh found new homelands in the wide open spaces of the Russian steppes. Other Israelite tribes were allied to them under the overall label of Saki, the seed or the root of Isaac. The Scythians all spoke the same Iranian language, who dominated Iran during the Scythian period. The answer is Parthia, and their common linguistic roots with the Parthians confirmed that the Scythians moved into the Russian steppes from the south, not out of the north. When America was being settled, Manassites were especially drawn to North America because of its promise of considerable living space. When Americans spread westward toward the Pacific Ocean, they migrated in wagon trains. In doing so, they carried on a tradition of the ancient Scythians. The Scythians also migrated by way of covered wagons, which are described in the following words. Quote, "The wagons in which the women and children traveled had from 4 to 6 wheels. They were covered with felt roofs, and the space inside was divided into 2 or 3 compartments. Little clay models of these prototypes of the modern caravan have been found in some Scythian burial mounds in the Middle East." Like the cowboys of the American West, the Scythians also excelled at lassoing and cattle raising. With their horse riding, lassoing, and wagon trains, Scythian culture resembled the pioneer days of the American West without the six-shooters. Perhaps the power of genetic influence is more potent than generally realized. After migrating into Europe with the other Israelite tribes, the modern Manassites found their long for wide open spaces in North America. The original 12 tribes of Israel grew to 13 tribes when Joseph was subdivided into the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. And since Ephraim was given its portion before Manasseh, Manasseh became the 13th tribe. And the number 13 has uniquely been associated with the founding of America. The United States of America was born as a union of 13 separate colonies with its flag exhibiting 13 stripes and 13 stars. The prominence of the number 13 in the founding of America indicates a divine hand influencing world events to indelibly stamp the number 13 on this new Manassite nation. Given the fractious history of the tribes of Israel, it is not logical that these 13 American colonies could have formed a cohesive new nation unless they collectively constituted regathered people from the tribe of Manasseh. And even as ancient Manasseh's territory in ancient Israel was divided in half by the Jordan River, modern Manasseh has become a nation with two halves on either side of the river, the Mississippi River. And while Manasseh loves wide open spaces, Ephraim has a habit of sending out colonies from a cramped homeland. And although Ephraim was the chief tribe of Israel, its inheritance in Palestine was very small by comparison. Since Ephraim, like Manasseh, was promised a huge population by God, where did their growing numbers migrate to? And as we saw in the first two books of this series, Israel colonized widely in North Africa, Europe, and even North America. And because Ephraim's inheritance in ancient Israel contained small or remained small, it had to export its growing population to new colonies. And as previous books in the series have documented, the Israelite settlers and colonies bore the Hebrew root word for covenant, that is BRT. And in their names and coins, we see BRT consistently and continuously. Since Ephraim and Manasseh were the covenant or birthright tribes, and since Manasseh had more room than Ephraim in ancient Israel, it is logical that many of the BRT, ISH people, colonizing under ancient Israel's banner were Ephraimites. The ancient Hebrew word for covenant still forms the root word for the modern English word British, BR. Since ISH is the Hebrew word for man, the word British is the Hebrew word or Hebrew equivalent to compounding the words meaning covenant men. How fitting, then, that the British people, the main covenant tribe of the House of Israel, are still known today by a Hebrew name proclaiming to the world their status as the covenant people. Well, hang on, boys and girls. We've got to take a quick break here. Let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. And for more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by pre-arrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School Direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. And most of the authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. And the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our website, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, this week we are reviewing the book Israel's Tribes Today. Where are they? The guy that wrote the book, his name is Stephen Collins, lives up in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Can anything good come out of South Dakota? Well, the one thing for sure in its five dynamite books on the history of the tribes of Israel. Where are they today? What are their historical roots? What did they accomplish in the past? Where are those indelible signposts in Michigan, Colorado, Louisiana, West Virginia, up in New England, New Hampshire, New York? Well, a number of scholars have written a number of books in a society called the Epigraphic Society, which keeps track of such things. And a fellow by the name of Barry Fell, who wrote a number of books, one of which is called American BC, that is America BC, Barry Fell is the guy's name. gives a much different history of the world and indeed of the North American and South American continents than we receive in our public schools and our public colleges. If you'd like a copy of this book, it's about $20. I don't know exactly. I sent him a $100 bill. And so let me just suggest that you send a $100 bill, and that'll cover the postage and the five books. That's about $20 a piece, postage paid. And while you're at it, tell him where you heard it and ask him to autograph the books for you. And he'll do that. Well, he did it for me. I think he'll do it for you. Five books. They're probably 300 to 400 pages each. Well, I won't say three or four. I'll say 250 to 300 pages each. There's five of them. Well documented. I mean, they're documented on top of documents on top of documents. If you want the proof, you could take any of the information contained in these books into court and present it as evidence. You can present it as evidence. Guy's name is Stephen Collins, 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57106. Again, that's Stephen Collins, 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57106. Now, the publisher is called Bible Blessings. If you want more information, why don't you go to their website? It's BibleBlessings.net. All one word, BibleBlessings.net. Or you can order these books one at a time from Bible Blessings, Post Office Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. That's Bible Blessings, Post Office Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. All right, we're talking about Israel's tribes today. Where are they located? Well, one of the early waves of Celtic immigrants into ancient Britain also bore the BRT name upon them. These Brythonic Celts, or Celts, also included the Hebrew word for covenant, BRT, as a root word in their tribal name. The Brythonic Celts settled largely in England and Wales, further strengthening the Israelite population of the British Isles. Indeed, Owen Edwards, in his 1901 book, Wales, noted that the Celts were a distinct relation to the Teutonic tribes of the Anglo-Saxons, the Danes, and the Normans. The Celts also inherited some of the promises made to Abraham. During their migrations to find homelands for their growing populations, they settled in Europe from the Atlantic coasts to Asia Minor. A portion of the Iberian Peninsula became known as Celtiberia, and some Celts in Asia Minor merged with the Scythians, becoming known as the Celto-Scyths. It is likely that many Celts were descendants of Ephraimites who had lived in colonies outside of Ephraim's cramped little homeland in ancient Israel. Parthia also had the BRT root word in its name, identifying it as a covenant tribe of Israel. The interchangeability of P's and B's in ancient language has been previously discussed. Parthia began with a fairly small homeland southeast of the Caspian Sea, but expanded into a huge empire ruling over many different nations. The modern British Empire also ruled over many nations, even though its homeland in the British Isles was fairly small. The British, like the Parthians of old, displayed an aptitude for managing an empire of diverse people in an organized manner. The British can be remarkably determined in warfare. Their standing alone against Hitler's Nazism, despite impossible odds, was, as Winston Churchill described it, their finest hour. A few thousand Ephraimites, who refused to flee from the Assyrians, withstood a siege of 3 years in Samaria before succumbing, as recorded in 2 Kings 17, verse 5. Book 3 in this series discussed a war in which the Parthians emerged victorious by refusing to give up, despite losing a series of major battles against a superior force of Seleucid Greeks. Parthia had its western capital burnt and its citizens massacred by the Romans in 216 AD, and yet they rallied to defeat the Roman Empire. And Ephraimites have a historic pattern of refusing to give up. In spite of Britain's post-war decline, this fighting spirit was revived when Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher dispatched English forces to defeat Argentina in 1982 after it had seized the Falkland Islands. Now, the Ephraimites' trait of refusing to quit under duress harkens back to the struggle of Jacob, the father of the tribes of Israel, who wrestled with a divine being all night, refusing to surrender to the superior being. The tribe of Ephraim has exhibited this trait of Jacob more than any other tribe of Israel. Genesis 32, verses 24 through 30, indicates that God is particularly impressed by this trait, which may be a major reason for the tribe of Ephraim being the dominant tribe of the house of Israel all throughout history. Genesis 49, verses 22 through 26, prophesies the following for Ephraim and Manasseh in the latter days. Referring to them jointly as Joseph shows that their fates will be very closely linked in the last days. The prophecy says, Joseph is a fruitful bough, even a fruitful bough by a well, whose branches run over the wall. The archers have sorely grieved him, and shot at him, and hated him. But his bow abode in strength, and his arms and his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob, even by the God of your father who shall help you, and by the Almighty who shall bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies under, blessings of the beasts and of the womb, and blessings of your father shall be on the head of Joseph. Now this very accurately describes Britain's Commonwealth and America in modern times. The analogy that these tribes are like spreading vines parallels the fact that Great Britain and America have projected their power and their influence far beyond their own homelands. Even though they have divested themselves of many colonies and protectorates, they still occupy most of two continents, North America and Australia, as well as the British Isles and a variety of Commonwealth nations and protectorates. The analogy to water by a well indicates that the nations of Ephraim and Manasseh, that's Great Britain, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and the United States, will be located on seacoasts adjacent to major bodies of water. And the fact that Joseph's nations are shot at and hated by enemy nations is apparent in the modern world. Both the English and the Americans have been envied because of their material wealth and their national power. Phrases like Yankee go home personify the jealousy and the envy that part of the world has toward the Anglo-Saxons. The word and the old Soviet Union work hard to stir up anti-Americanism among the uneducated third world nations by falsely characterizing Americans as Yankee imperialists. Americans do not have an imperialistic bone in their bodies. America had the opportunity to impose any imperial intentions and its will upon the entire world after World War II. And instead of establishing an imperial empire when it was theirs for the taking, the Americans quickly brought their troops home to their own families and their own farms and their own factories. Now, Genesis 49 also prophesied that the tribe of Joseph would have considerable military strength in the latter days. The phrase, his bow abode in strength, refers to weaponry. This also has been true in the modern world, as the greatest military advantage in recorded history was in the hands of America and Great Britain at the end of World War II, even though Presidents George Bush and Bill Clinton dramatically reduced the size of the American armed forces. America's status as a military superpower is well known worldwide. And while the British scrapped most of their famous naval fleet in recent decades, it still has a respectable nuclear arsenal. And both the British and the Americans have won wars in recent years. Great Britain won the Falklands War, and the Americans, supported by the British, French, and others, routed the army of Saddam Hussein in the Persian Gulf. America, supported by the British, also routed the Taliban in Afghanistan and destroyed Saddam Hussein's military forces in 2003. And Genesis 49's use of the word bow to depict the weaponry of Ephraim and Manasseh is very significant. Bows and arrows were favored weapons of ancient Israel, Parthia, Scythia, and England in the Middle Ages. Parthia dedicated half of its cavalry to bowmen who fired arrows at their enemies. The English soldiers of the Middle Ages were famous for their use of the long bow and the crossbow. When Scythia sent a symbolic message to King Darius depicting how the Persians would fall under Scythian attack, they sent a clump of arrows as their sign of war. Genesis 49, verse 22, and its reference to Joseph as a fruitful branch in the latter days is also interesting. What nation in the modern world is symbolized by the twin symbols of a branch and arrows, as prophesied in Genesis chapter 49? The olive branch and a clump of arrows held in an eagle's claw is the national symbol of the United States. The crest of the United States of America is an eagle clutching an olive branch and a clump of arrows in its talons. The olive branch signifies America's desire for peace, while the arrows signify prowess in war. Is it only coincidence that the ancient Scythians or the Saki, the nation, used the same war sign, a clump of arrows, as modern America, a Saxon nation, and also the eagle was a common symbol of the Scythians? One Scythian eagle crest was found in a pose suggestive of the modern eagle crest of the United States. Both show eagles with outstretched wings and flared tail feathers. The Scythian eagle holds prey in its talons, while the American eagle holds a branch and a clump of arrows in its talons. Indeed, the eagle crest of the United States not only proclaims Scythian roots, but also proclaims a Manassite origin of having 13 arrows in one talon, 13 leaves on the olive branch in the other talon, 13 stars over the eagle's head, 13 bars in the shield over the eagle's body, and 13 letters in the phrase E pluribus unum. Manasseh is the 13th tribe of Israel. The national symbols of Great Britain are also found in the Bible and in Bible prophecy. Deuteronomy chapter 33 also contains prophecies about the futures of the tribes of Israel, which assist in identifying some of Israel's tribes. After reiterating in verse 13 through 16 that Joseph will be blessed with remarkable prosperity in material things, verse 17 says, quote, his glory is like the firstling of his bullock, and his horns are like the horns of unicorns. With them he shall push the people together to the ends of the earth, and they are the 10,000s of Ephraim, and they are the thousands of Manasseh. unquote. In Numbers 23 and 24, the prophet Balaam was compelled by the Spirit of God to pronounce blessings on Israel's tribes before they entered Canaan. In Numbers 23, verses 22 through 24, Israel's strength is likened to that of a unicorn and a great lion. Numbers 24, verses 8 and 9 repeats that Israel will be likened unto a unicorn and a lion. Now, what modern nation has been jointly symbolized by a bullock, a unicorn, and a lion? Well, the heraldry of Great Britain include the unicorn and the lion, and the British Empire truly did push together. They did conquer and then govern many nations to the ends of the earth under these symbols. The bullock symbol also is attached to the British people, as the term John Bull has traditionally described the British people. The subject of the prophecy in Deuteronomy 33, verse 17, is that the tribes of Joseph will push together. They will rule. They will conquer. They will govern many other people to the ends of the earth throughout the world. The people named in this prophecy are not the populations of Ephraim and Manasseh, but rather the people conquered or ruled over by Ephraim and Manasseh. The 10,000s of Ephraim and the thousands of Manasseh refer to the numbers of people who are respectively pushed together to the ends of the earth by the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. This reflects the reality of what has occurred in world history. Ephraim, the British dominated, the people who have ruled many more people and nations around the earth than did Manasseh, America, the United States. And in Deuteronomy 33, verses 13 through 16, also is a prophecy concerning Ephraim and Manasseh, that they will inherit great material wealth. Their prophesied inheritance of the blessings of the heavens above, the precious things of the lasting hills, and for the precious things of the earth, mean that these tribes will have blessings of temperate climate, agricultural prosperity, and natural resources such as oil, iron, coal, gold, silver, and other material blessings. And all of these things are inherited and have been inherited by America and the English-speaking nations. The great wealth of the Anglo-Saxon nations has not been a result of good luck, but has been caused by the intervention of the Creator God in world affairs in order to implement these prophecies that Ephraim and Manasseh would have the lion's share of the earth's wealth. A literal interpretation of the Bible requires that the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh must be found among the biggest, wealthiest, and most powerful nations on planet Earth. And this is another key point about the tribe of Ephraim. The kings of ancient Israel were seated in Samaria, located in the territory of Ephraim in Asia. The main branch of the Arsacid kings, descended from King David, was seated in the empire of Parthia, which was formed by a reunification of the clans of Ephraim. And throughout history, the primary throne of Israelite kings has been located in the region of Ephraim, the chief birthright tribe of Israel. Earlier, it was noted that the royalty of the British ruling house are direct descendants of King David. So even now, in modern times, the throne of David is located among the modern Ephraimites in Great Britain. And this fact highlights a contrast between the Ephraimites and the Manassites. Ephraim is a monarchist, and Manasseh is not. The English are monarchists. The Americans are not. And the Bible notes an interesting difference between these tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh that has been fulfilled in modern times. Isaiah 11 is a prophecy about the Messianic kingdom being established among the nations. And verse 13 prophesies that in that day Ephraim shall not vex Judah, and Judah shall not vex Ephraim. Now notice that while Ephraim is prophesied to have a vexing relationship with the tribe of Judah until the Messianic kingdom of God is established, Manasseh is not mentioned as having a vexing relationship with Judah. This prophetic omission indicates that Manasseh will not have a vexing relationship with Judah in the latter day or in the latter days preceding the Messianic kingdom on planet Earth. How has this been fulfilled in modern times? Well, the British and the Jews have had a difficult relationship in modern times. In fact, there is so much bad blood between the two that it has caused during the time of the English mandate over Palestine from 1945 to 48 that the Jews felt that the English had a pro-Arab bias during this period. During this period of English rule that has predated Jewish independence and the English regarding the Jews as terrorists who killed British troops in incidents such as the blowing up of the King David Hotel. The British Navy intercepted boatloads of Jewish refugees, preventing their arrival in the Holy Land. The movie Exodus provided insights into this period of time. The British blockade among the Jewish acts of sabotage and the English executions of Jewish saboteurs led to very hostile Jewish-British relations. And while the British, that is Ephraim, and Jews, Judah, were barely on speaking terms, the United States of America, Manasseh, was one of Israel's strongest advocates in the United Nations, and the United States officially recognized Jewish independence as soon as it was proclaimed. And in the various Jewish-Arab wars, the United States of America was Israel's great ally and protector, rushing arms and support to the Jewish state in its wars. And sometimes the United States was the only friend that Israel had at the United Nations. And it was the United States who midwifed the famous Camp David Accords that united the three leaders, President Jimmy Carter, Anwar Sadat of Egypt, and Menachem Begin of Israel, in a famous photo of reconciliation in 1978. Well, this story, called Israel's Tribes Today, continues next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Let me give you a reminder that this book is available from the publisher, BibleBlessings.com. If you want to get them on the webpage, just go to BibleBlessings.net. I said com, it's BibleBlessings.net, N-E-T. Or if you'd like to order the book, you can do that at Bible Blessings, Post Office Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. Again, that's Bible Blessings, Post Office Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068. I'd recommend that you buy all five books. There's a series. There's a sixth book that's in the production stage, or at the writing stage, I guess, at this juncture of time. Send a $100 bill to Stephen M. Collins, 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57106. Again, that's Stephen Collins, 3901 Crescent Drive, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, 57106. I can't recommend the books any higher than that. If you want to know and understand your roots, as Alex Haley did with his black roots, if you want to understand your white roots and where you came from, and why America and Great Britain are the nations that they are, and why they're hated and reviled around the world, and why it is that America and Britain are on the slippery slope to national captivity and oblivion, these five books will tell you that story. All right, let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our webpage. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Well, our time is up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, with more on Israel's Tribes Today. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.